This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner could be excused if he has some extra spring in his step. The troubled car company posted a fourth quarter profit of almost $1 billion this morning. That's quite a turnaround from the billions in red ink just a couple of months ago. So you feel kind of bad that Wagoner and some CEO colleagues had to spend the day on the defensive at a congressional hearing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's March 14th today, and it's either plain bad luck or terrible timing that Detroit seems to be turning around just as Congress is turning to global warming. GM's restructuring to get in tune with America's shifting taste for more fuel-efficient cars. But even today's profit isn't enough to get the world's largest automaker to support stricter fuel economy rules. Executives from U.S. and foreign automakers were in Washington today, along with the United Auto Workers Union, lobbying hard against proposals requiring higher mileage. That's a rare alliance, and it offers a glimpse into just how high the financial stakes are as Congress tries to craft climate change legislation. Sam Eaton reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
For the past three decades, the fuel economy standards for cars and trucks sold in the U.S. have remained unchanged, a fleet-wide average of just under 25 miles per gallon. Pressure in Washington to address climate change is now driving a new round of proposals to boost mileage requirements, or CAFE standards, to about 35 miles per gallon over the next decade. But automakers are crying foul. Their argument? It would cost too much. Peter Brown with Automotive News says they may have a point.
They're struggling, so anything they have to spend on fuel economy that they think their customers don't want to pay for is a big problem for them. They don't have any extra money.
A White House estimate says boosting fuel economy standards could cost the industry about $114 billion. Automakers favor climate change legislation that wouldn't single out any one industry, something like an economy-wide cap on greenhouse gas emissions. But David Friedman with the Union of Concerned Scientists says putting a price on CO2 would only raise the cost of gasoline by about 20 cents a gallon, leaving little incentive for U.S. consumers to abandon gas-guzzling SUVs.
We've seen gasoline prices more than double over the past 5 years, with only a small impact on gasoline demand and greenhouse gas pollution. The automakers know very well that a 20-cent increase in gas prices is going to leave them off the hook.
Friedman says the irony is that if Congress had been raising fuel economy standards over the past three decades, U.S. automakers today wouldn't be losing so much ground to Toyota and its fleet of fuel-efficient cars. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Today had all the signs of another rout in the equity markets, at least till lunchtime or so. There was a 200-point swing from low to high, much of the nervousness caused by, once again, the subprime mortgage market. But not everybody's skittish about those subprimes. Some big names on Wall Street are stepping up. Kate Kelly's with the Wall Street Journal. Kate, good to speak with you.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Let me make sure I have this right. Investors are running away from subprimes. Regulators are taking a very close look, yet Goldman Sachs somehow sees opportunity here.
They do. I mean, Goldman has been a relatively small but sort of active player in the subprime space for a while. And they have said there are two things that concern them. One is the sort of reputation risk of being associated with these companies, which don't have a great reputation themselves. The other is just kind of the timing of the cycle. And there were other investment banks that bought subprime lenders at higher points in the market and paid big prices. Goldman now realizes that given all the turmoil in the sector, they might be able to snap up one of the lenders for a fire sale price, basically.
They're obviously a bunch of smart people over there. They just reported record profits. But unless they can change the business model somehow, isn't subprimes these days sort of like squeezing blood from a stone?
Obviously, it's been a sort of troubled model for a while, and it kind of doesn't make sense to sign people up for mortgages that they can't possibly afford. So it does appear that there are going to be some tweaks in the marketplace, to say the least. The CFO of Goldman talked a little bit about the need for high standards yesterday. However, nobody thinks that subprime lending is going to disappear. It's still a sector of the marketplace where the lenders can make some profits, and I think it's here to stay.
Let me get back to this reputation thing for a minute. Doesn't it sort of look just a bit, rapacious, frankly, getting in there and getting what they can?
There is this issue of the sleaze factor, and I think they're concerned about that. And they've said that any acquisition we make, we're going to subject to our usual standards and make sure that we're involved in a quality enterprise. I do think they would probably argue this is an amoral sort of business situation, and they're trying to make money for their shareholders by taking a good business opportunity.
Kate, in your article this morning, you also talked about the Massachusetts regulators who have issued some subpoenas to Bear Stearns and UBS about some stock research that they wrote. What more can you tell us about that?
This is a case where the security secretary in Massachusetts is trying to crack down on what he feels was disingenuous research or even just sort of poorly conceived research on New Century and the mortgage sector, New Century being the Irvine-based subprime lender that's had so many troubles of late. But in the Bear Stearns case, this analyst had essentially a sell rating on the company up until March 1st when he upgraded his rating to the equivalent of a neutral. The company sort of imploded not long thereafter, and it was a bad time to be anywhere close to bullish about it. However, to be fair to the company and the analyst, he did make the point that he thought investors might be best served sort of waiting on the sidelines, and he points out some of the issues that were at the company. So I do think the guy had a more nuanced view. On the other hand, going from a sell to a neutral when a company's on the brink of collapse isn't the best.
So yeah, it sort of adds to the doesn't really look good factor. Right?
Yeah. No, fair enough.
Kate Kelly at the Wall Street Journal. She covers investment banks for the paper. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. Have a good one.
A good one is what it turned out to be on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The United Nations says there are more than 500,000 people in Thailand living with HIV. To treat them, the Thai government's broken patents on a number of medicines made by major pharmaceutical companies, including Abbott Labs. Abbott Labs makes a tablet called Keletra. As a result, Abbott announced today it won't sell any new drugs in Thailand. Sarah Gardner has more.
Abbott Labs declined to be interviewed today but released a terse statement accusing Thailand of breaking patents on numerous medicines. But health activists say it's not that simple.
We believe the most important thing is to ensure that there's access to the essential medicines.
Dr. Budima Lokuge is with Doctors Without Borders. He and other health activists say Thailand's overriding of Abbott's patent is legal. Under World Trade Organization rules, governments can bypass drug patent laws and opt for cheaper generic versions in the case of national emergency. Thailand claims it has one. The country has more than 500,000 HIV/AIDS patients, and health officials say Keletra's $347 a month price tag is unaffordable. Anti-patent activist James Love.
If you live in a developing country, what these drug companies are doing is they're selling things so only the people in the top income brackets can afford them. That's the profit maximizing price.
Abbott had been negotiating with Thai officials on a lower price for Keytruda, but no agreement was reached. Christopher Paul Milne at the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development says he believes Abbott was probably more worried by Thailand's decision to declare a crisis over another more commonly used drug, Plavix, a blood thinner for heart patients.
Whether it meets the conditions of being an emergency situation. Certainly Plavix is not a drug where you could probably make a good argument for that.
Drug makers have argued if their patents can be broken easily, they'll have no incentive to develop new drugs in the future. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Today, the United States Senate began its first real debate on Iraq since Democrats took over. All the talking senators have done so far has been about whether or not to have that debate. The Democratic proposal on the floor calls for troop withdrawals to start this summer and to have all Americans out of Iraq a year from now. The plan likely won't pass, and even if it did, it would certainly be vetoed at the White House. Commentator Newt Gingrich suggests troops are important, but lawmakers and the president ought to be fixing other things, too.
We want the Iraqi government to succeed, but we aren't setting much of an example. Take our reconstruction efforts. We have to follow cumbersome federal acquisition laws whenever we spend U.S. dollars in Iraq. In one case, we awarded a contract to a Finnish company for 20 17-megawatt generators. The delivery took over 2 years. The process is so complex, it has essentially shut Iraqis out of the bidding process. They don't understand the American system. So most contracts go to foreign companies instead of Iraqi-owned businesses. Meanwhile, unemployment and underemployment in Iraq is around 48%. If we jump-started more than 150 old and new Iraqi factories, we could create tens of thousands of new jobs. But instead, we're squabbling over where the money should come from and who should get the contracts. Instead of debating a troop surge, the President and Congress should focus on making our government work in Iraq. They could start by fixing our broken acquisition system. They can follow a model that already exists. Provisional reconstruction teams are allowed to dole out small amounts of money to get jobs done fast without going through red tape. Congress should expand the amount of money these teams can spend to get jobs done quickly. And Congress should overhaul and simplify the entire acquisition process so Iraqi businesses can compete. We've got to speed up the process between approval and when projects start. It's true that could lead to more waste, but the risk is small compared to a more rapid, more successful reconstruction. We can still win in Iraq, but doing so requires fixing the broken bureaucracies here in Washington. After all, if our government doesn't work, how can we expect to help the Iraqis create one that does?
Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House of Representatives back in the mid-90s. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Go to our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Take everything that goes in and out of this country, from cash to car parts. That's an economic statistic called the current account, the broadest measure of U.S. trade with the rest of the world. The Commerce Department reported this morning the current account's deficit hit a record for a fifth straight year last year. It's a government number from respected and nonpartisan professional bureaucrats. Over in Britain, official reports have a history of being less than entirely objective. Parliament has created an independent statistics office, but Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London. For many, the numbers still don't add up.
The British government loves to bombard the British people with statistics.
The New Deal alone has helped 2 million people. Youth unemployment is down three quarters. 4,000 more student nurses and midwives.
We've raised the number of young people in work by 250,000. We've also raised the number of young people in full-time education.
80,000 more classroom assistants.
But the barrage of figures depicting a wealthier, healthier and happier Britain falls on stony ground. 80% of the British people don't entirely trust official statistics. And they're right, says Vincent Cable, economic spokesman for the opposition Liberal Democrat Party.
Governments manipulate statistics, whether it's on school leavers or hospital waiting lists or crimes, and they can be interpreted in different ways, and they're always given a political spin.
Treasury Minister John Healey says the new law should restore public trust in government figures.
For the first time, we'll have an independent system for statistics run by a board that is independent from ministers reporting to Parliament and no longer to ministers.
But Martin Wheel of the National Institute for Economic and Social Research says even under the new law, there's plenty of room to massage the numbers.
It's going to be ministers and not the statistics board which decide whether statistics are national statistics or not.
Under this slightly Orwellian arrangement, say the critics, the board won't handle some of the most politically sensitive statistics like crime figures, healthcare waiting lists or public exam results. And the new law leaves intact one of the most controversial aspects of the old system, says Professor Tim Holt of the Royal Statistical Society. Ministers still get a long look at the figures before anyone else.
The bill allows ministers to keep to themselves the right to decide who gets pre-release access and for the length of time and so on.
In the US, the president gets to see important official data the afternoon before the day of release. In Britain, ministers get the stuff a whole week before. And why not, asks Treasury Minister John Healey.
Pre-release access is important. It allows ministers to account for the impact of policy at the same time as significant data is released.
Also, say the cynics, it allows ministers time to spin and manipulate the figures. Andrew Hilton of the Centre for the Study of Financial Innovation says the new statistics board is itself an exercise in spin. Britain is not at the dawn of a new age of numerical purity.
Numerical purity is really like virginity. Once you've lost it, you can't get it back. And I think that governments are never going to give up the power to spin the data.
Tweaking the numbers is self-defeating, he says. Such is the public mistrust that governments won't get the credit, even when the numbers haven't been tweaked and are genuinely good. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, a church where parishioners might pay a high price for their convictions.
They get no money, they get no property, but they do get their integrity, and they get to proceed and worship as they believe they are called to do.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials briefly sank below the 12,000 level, a depth it hadn't explored since last fall, and then reemerged like a rapidly surfacing submarine today. By the time investors wrapped up their wild maneuvers, the blue chip index was floating back above the waves at 12,133. That's a lift of 57 points, around a half a percentage point. The NASDAQ bobbed up 21 points, 0.9%, closed at 2731. The S&P 500 rose 9 points, that's 0.2%, finishing at 1387. Hard-hit financial stocks recovered today when bargain hunters swept in. Shares of the country's top mortgage lender, Countrywide Financial, picked up 2.7%. At the same time, stock in Bear Stearns, the leading underwriter of mortgage bonds, regained 1.6% of its value after yesterday's 6.7% sell-off. Bond prices slipped. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 4.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the February Producer Price Index. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice addresses the Summit on Global Aging. Hosted by the State Department, this conference aims to stimulate international dialogue on challenges emerging as people around the world live longer. And beware the Ides of March. If you don't believe in that sort of thing, it's simply March 15th. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you thought American CEOs of big companies had a lock on scandalous behavior, we direct your attention to the federal courthouse in Chicago, Illinois. Canadian media mogul Conrad Black went on trial for fraud there today. The list of particulars brings back memories of Dennis Kozlowski and Tyco, spending company money as if it were his, and the small matter of $84 million missing. James Langton used to work at a Conrad Black paper, the Daily Telegraph in London. Mr. Langton, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Remind us who Conrad Black is, would you?
Conrad Black is an old-fashioned media baron whose empire at one point stretched, if not quite all around the world. It certainly included the Daily and Sunday Telegraph in London, the Jerusalem Post, and a great raft of newspapers across Canada and in Chicago.
And it's those papers in Chicago and all the rest of that publishing empire that's gotten him into a bit of trouble, isn't it?
It is, yes. Hollinger was the parent company that owned all these papers, and Hollinger was based in Chicago, which is why the trial is in Chicago, even though perhaps many people in the U.S. may not be as familiar with him as we are over here, where he was, you know, very much a man of the headlines in every sense.
In what way? Describe him for us.
If you said he was larger than life, that would be about right. He's physically quite an imposing man, always extremely well-dressed, very expensive suits, never shy to come forward with his opinions in print or in speech. In some senses, he's a kind of Citizen Kane-like figure in that he really enjoyed the privileges of wealth and power that owning a successful chain of newspapers brought with it.
Well, you actually used to work for the Daily Telegraph in London, one of his. What was he like as a boss?
I was fairly well down the food chain, but I have to say that as a proprietor, he was pretty good. Although he had very strong opinions and we knew what he liked and disliked, nevertheless, he pretty much left his editors to get on with what they wanted to do. He loved newspapers, which is always a good thing to have a proprietor who actually loves the business of journalism and producing newspapers. You know, sometimes these days you get the impression you're working for accountants, but he was a man who really relished owning newspapers and loved the business of it.
Now, he's accused of some fairly, scandalous might be a bit strong, but unusual things. $53,000 for his wife's birthday party, in theory on company money, taking the company jet to Bora Bora for a vacation. How do you think that's going over, you know, amongst his peers?
These are clearly things that the prosecutors will hope will play very strongly to the jury. They're not actually central to the case against him, but these, if you like, will embroider their case. And I suspect they'll try and create an impression of this man as a kind of Citizen Kane filled with hubris in an attempt to get a conviction.
Care to hazard a guess for us how long this trial might last?
My suspicion is that will depend to an extent whether the defense decides to allow Mr. Black to take the stand, because he's a man who can go on at great length on subjects, and I should think, given his head, he could probably occupy that entire 3 months in his defense. But the 3 months is what they're saying.
Any wagers on what might happen?
I think it's always very difficult with financial cases because it does depend to an extent on whether the jury feel they've kind of got a grip of what was going on. They can be quite complex. And in this case, I think the prosecutors will attempt to keep it very simple and portray this as a greedy man and a greedy wife who looted the company. But I believe his defense will be that these payments were authorized by the Hollinger board, and therefore they were just, paying him for his services.
James Langton is a freelance reporter in the United Kingdom. We've reached him just outside London. Mr. Langton, thank you so much for your time.
That's a pleasure.
Leaders of the Episcopal Church meet tomorrow in Texas. They're facing an ultimatum from the Worldwide Anglican Communion. That's their parent church. Anglican bishops are upset with their American colleagues over their positions on gay rights and interpretation of Scripture. There's been talk of forcing Episcopalians out of the larger group. More than 100 congregations in this country have joined the Anglicans and are threatening to leave the U.S. church. The split is over moral issues, but Eric Neela reports there is also a more earthly fight going on.
The Falls Church was here long before the wealthy suburban city that took its name. This is prime real estate. Church official Carol Jackson points out where members were buried before the Revolutionary War even began.
We're looking at what they call the churchyard, which is a composite of graves, and then in the distance we have a memorial garden. The churchyard has been in use since the 1700s.
Later on, the church became a Union horse stable during the Civil War. But these days, this historic property finds itself in the middle of another battle. It's between conservative congregants and what they see as a too liberal Episcopal church. In December, the congregation voted to leave the mother church. Since then, national and state church officials have sued to take over the land and buildings, worth more than $20 million. But Jackson says the members want what they believe is rightfully theirs.
We've all been making contributions financially in varying proportions forever.
It's getting ugly. The congregation threatened Virginia officials with trespassing if they showed up at services. The Falls Church has an operating budget of more than $5 million. It runs ministries, schools, and a payroll of more than 50 staffers. But if the congregation disagrees with the national church, who gets control? Attorney Stephen Johnson represents the congregants.
In terms of the equities, it's important to remember that the congregations built these property. We haven't received a dime from the denomination to build these structures. In fact, in some cases, the structures predate the existence of the denomination.
The National Church strongly disagrees. The Reverend Jan Nunley is a spokeswoman for the Episcopal Church.
The congregation may hold a deed to a church building, but the property is legally held in trust for all Episcopalians, past, present, and future.
The Episcopal Church is fighting at least half a dozen similar lawsuits across the country. It's already won cases in New York, North Carolina, Missouri, and Pennsylvania. Nunley says it's the church's duty to protect its assets.
Going to the courts is a shame to the church, and we're not happy about these situations. But we also have a fiduciary responsibility ourselves.
The courts must decide whether church law or civil property law wins out. Church law expert Martin Nussbaum believes the Supreme Court has already set a precedent in this area. He predicts the breakaway congregations will lose.
They get no money, they get no property, but they do get their integrity, and they get to proceed and worship as they believe they are called to do.
Still, Carol Jackson of the Falls Church says she and other members won't go quietly. This is where they've married and buried their loved ones.
I mean, it would be a whole different dynamic for us to no longer be identified with this location, and we're certainly not willing to give that up easily.
At last month's meeting of Anglican leaders in Tanzania, church leaders called for both sides in the U.S. to drop legal proceedings against each other. But given the high stakes, that's one commandment not likely to be followed. In Falls Church, Virginia, I'm Eric Kneeler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a California judge dropped all charges against former Hewlett-Packard chairwoman Patricia Dunn today. Three other defendants pleaded no contest to misdemeanor charges. Dunn and some other top HP executives were accused of spying on their own board members and outside journalists last year. They were trying to figure out who was leaking inside information to those reporters. Dunn was eventually forced to resign from the board. Today's ruling settles state charges, but federal prosecutors say their investigation is ongoing. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. A happier day on Wall Street today. The Dow rose 57 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ gained 21 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 picked up 9 points, 0.2% there. Thanks to Miguel Macias for getting up in the middle of the night and working on our morning report. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, it is time to get hooked.
When you knit, you completely divorce yourself from the world around you. All your problems and your troubles just disappear. It is addiction, and it's the only addiction that you can use needles, and it's legal.
You got it. Hooked, right? Anyway, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.